This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson. John Dankosky's away. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from a panel I hosted at the University of Hartford called Leveling the Playing Field, Access to Quality Education and Healthcare, part of their Empowering Change week-long celebration of the Civil Rights Act. But first, I'm joined by one of the panelists, Marie Spivey, Vice President for Health Equity at the Connecticut Hospital Association. Spivey works with hospitals around the state to increase diversity in senior management and strategize on how to more effectively and thoughtfully respond to the needs of the diverse communities they serve. I began by asking her about the intersection between education and healthcare.
Let me just start by saying that you can't separate out education from health, from housing, from transportation, etc. What affects one affects another. I think we can all think about how we felt growing up and going to school. And if you were hungry, you weren't in great shape. If you had gone to bed late, you weren't in great shape. Certainly, we know that that if a child is healthy and going to school, they're going to be better educated as they grow up. If there are people in the classroom that understand what their culture is about, what their language is about, what their whole situation, home situation is about, if the child is happy or not, if there's mental illness lurking in the background. Teachers are expected to do a lot more than really they are trained to do, and I think that's something that we can take a look at a bit more seriously.
How does low achievement contribute to gaps and disparities in healthcare?
Well, low achievement causes disparities. Children who are not learning, children who are not absorbing or haven't been offered information about health and healthcare and how to take care of themselves, low self-esteem. There are going to be disparities in health because of the health non-literacy.
What are the biggest challenges that healthcare providers have in terms of addressing some of those issues?
Yeah, one of the most prominent elements that we look at in the hospitals is the culture and language barriers and education barriers. And what we need is more medical interpreters available for every shift who understand not just a language, but several languages and the culture of how you approach people. The approach is extremely important because people really are very afraid when they come into the hospital. And if you are of another language, you may have something wrong with your stomach and you express it differently. And the assumption is made that, especially if you are a person of color, maybe you are a substance abuser or you are intoxicated. And lo and behold, you have appendicitis. I mean, we really have to do something about this language barrier. And it begins with respect, and it goes into knowing and understanding more culture, more languages. The reason that we started looking at the diversity in the boards and the senior management and management in particular, the reasons we did that is because they're not diverse enough to know about the populations we serve. They're not reflecting the communities we serve, and that is critical. And so where you have people of different backgrounds and diversity is in food services and in janitorial services. And do we ever ask those people what's happening in their communities? That's what we need to do, look inside as well as externally and bring people together to have better conversations.
So what kind of legislation or policies are in the works right now to address some of these issues?
Let me start from the federal government. The federal government has now created, from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, through the Office of Minority Health, has created regional health equity councils. And there are 10 across the country. Here in New England, I co-chair the New England Regional Health Equity Council. And that council is focusing in on policies for community health workers, for example, because community health workers normally come from the community. They live in the community. They know their community. And they are being hired by, they have been for years and years, by community health centers, but they're also hired by hospitals and other organizations. Those individuals are grant funded. And when the grants go away, the jobs go away. And so what we're trying to do in New England is look at, and I think we're connecting with people across the country as well, we're trying to focus in on community health workers and the funding opportunities from Medicaid, for example. Medicaid funding to organizations such as hospitals and other healthcare organizations that that staff with community health workers, because they really are the bottom rung on the healthcare career pipeline, if you will. But they are not supported in a way that is beneficial to the community or the organization that is staffing, that has them employed. So I think policy level, we need to look at how we make sure that we're going from the first rung of a healthcare career pipeline to the nursing and the physicians. I think that other policies that we're working on now is with nurses. The Northern Connecticut Black Nurses Association has just created a mentoring program for nursing students that are in education institutions here in the state of Connecticut. And it is the mentoring is just so wonderful, because this is what these students need. When I was in nursing school, I won't say the hospital, but there were three of us in the school of, you know, several hundred. And it was difficult, and it's still difficult. So the mentoring we need to do as Black nurses, we need to do this not just here and on the northern side of Connecticut, but we're also connecting with the Southern Nursing Black Nurses Association to work on those kinds of things. So it is excellent. CHA is part of the National Association of Health Services Executives, which it's a national Black organization of healthcare professionals. And that the intent of creating a Connecticut chapter is to identify healthcare professionals and those that want to get into the profession for people of color and give them that support and that respect.
Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marie Spivey is Vice President for Health Equity at the Connecticut Hospital Association. Coming up, we'll hear more from Dr. Spivey and others who were part of a panel discussion this week called Leveling the Playing Field in Education and Healthcare. Stay with us. I'm Diane Orson, in for John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson. All this week, the University of Hartford has hosted events and programs marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. They've been designed to encourage reflection on what was accomplished back then as a way to ask ourselves, what can we do now? I was invited to moderate a panel discussion called Leveling the Playing Field, Education and Healthcare, and we'll listen now to part of that conversation. Our panelists were State Senator Beth Bye, Hartford Public Schools Chief of Staff Ghislaine Ngunu, Marie Spivey, Vice President for Health Equity at the Connecticut Hospital Association, and University of Hartford professors Karen D'Angelo, Health Sciences, John Tapper, Elementary Education, and Kenny Nienhusser, Educational Leadership. I began by asking the panel what they think are the most persistent inequalities in relation to healthcare and education access, and how can we begin to level the playing field? Here's Marie Spivey.
As I began thinking about this question, I was brought back to recalling what I learned from my family and from my friends and others about segregation and its effect on quality education and access to quality health services. For one example, as most of us know, the Brown versus the Board of Education, acknowledged as one of the greatest Supreme Court decisions of the 20th century,
unanimously held that the racial segregation of children in public schools violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Although that decision didn't succeed in fully desegregating public education in the United States at that time or now, it put the Constitution on the side of racial equality and galvanized the emerging civil rights movement. Yes, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects people of every race, color, and national origin from unlawful discrimination, but that's only when the situation is brought to light. We know that discrimination continues. We know how, we know why, and we know that there needs to be more of a willingness to make change. So empowering change is something that we have talked about for a long, long time, and we'll get there.
I think it's important to lay out sort of the landscape of sort of where we are and some issues with education that our nation faces, as well as the state of Connecticut and even here in Hartford. Here in Hartford, we see rates of dropout 2.5 times higher than that in Connecticut. You know, and these figures, you know, I'm not coming with these figures for us to go ahead and point fingers, right, at school districts or at states that are not doing the job that they should be doing, in my opinion, right? But instead, for us to say that we are not educating bright students, and what's happening with these students is that they're dropping out or they're not being as successful as what they could be, right? It's important for us as educators to give the supports that students need for them to be successful in their education. Now, here in Hartford, we also see sometimes some populations, particularly Latino students, with dropout rates as high as 14% in recent years, right? Think about that in terms of educational earnings, right? Then think about that in terms of health disparities that we're going to talk about in this panel, right? So it's important that we think about how these things are really detrimental to populations. Now, if we think about high school to college transition, which is where a lot of my research focuses on, let's talk a little bit about SAT scores, right? SAT scores, sort of the marker, right, for students to go on into certain types of institutions, right? And if we look at comparing SAT scores, U.S., Connecticut is 30th, right? So it's right around the middle average in terms of SAT scores, right? But then if we sort of peel that layer out a little bit and look at Hartford, we see a very different story, right, with students that are scoring about 312 points lower than that of the state. So if we think about that, it's concerning because more than likely those students are not going to be going to more selective institutions, and then we have all those issues that come with that.
So drawing upon what my colleagues have said, I'm just going to contextualize a little bit about the inequities that we are facing as a country in regards to health. So health inequities are dramatic and alarming in the United States. And they are defined as differences in health status between population groups that are avoidable, systematic, unfair, and unjust. And not surprisingly, hearing the differences in educational attainment and educational access, these health inequities are rooted in the social determinants of health. So the social determinants of health are really the conditions of daily life that frame our health. So things like access to quality education, access to quality healthcare services, access to clean air, quality, nutritious food, low stress, participation in the society, democratic participation, those kind of things. And when you look across communities in the United States, we see dramatic differences in access to these conditions and dramatic differences in the quality of these conditions. So that has a lot to do with why certain population groups, particularly communities of color and those with fewer economic resources, are dying at alarming rates, much more often than white communities, as well as those with more affluence. Additionally, however, we also have a problem with health care in terms of health care disparities. So studies have shown that in health care, even when we control for access-related factors, so we're controlling for insurance access and health care coverage, quality of health care for people of color is far worse as compared to whites. I think one thing that's really important in contributing to annihilating this problem is the role of the community. So communities can play an important role in terms of community-based research and identifying innovative solutions to the health inequities that they face. Also, community health workers are an important bridge between the Western healthcare system and indigenous communities in which they're from in terms of cultural practices and language barriers and misunderstandings. And empowering community both in the interaction with the healthcare provider and in the healthcare system is really important and is necessary to address health inequities.
I'd like to dig a little deeper into one area, which is I've been hearing about both institutions, which are represented here, education and healthcare, not serving students of color, not serving patients of color and Latinos in the way they should be served, that there needs to be a deeper look at belief systems of the people that they serve. Can we talk a little bit about this idea of cultural competency? Could somebody define what that is? First of all, define what do we mean by cultural competency and the role that it plays and can play in training the next generation of teachers and healthcare workers to more effectively serve their the students and clients.
I think the notion of cultural competency expands beyond an interaction between communities of color and maybe white educators or healthcare providers. And I think an added element to what's required for cultural competency to happen is for people to be provided the tools so that they can examine their own sense of identity. Because when we talk about cultural competency, there are issues of race, class, identity, gender, and whatever else that may exist. But I don't believe that until one is able to spend time reflecting on one's own sense of identity and understanding what makes up that whole aspect of one's personality, I think one has to be able to do that and also be able to become highly aware of the biases and the stereotypes that we bring to the work that we do on a daily basis in our interactions with others. Then we can begin to understand others, and we can begin to understand, in education in particular, then we can begin to understand the communities and the young people that we serve. And so that we don't approach the work that we do from a deficit mentality and a deficit perspective, but we begin to see young people and communities and families as places that have resources and assets. And we begin to value what they bring to the table beyond what our traditional definitions of resources and success and caring about one's child and one's child's education and future looks like. An example, I think data shows that, more and more we have resegregation in schools. And unfortunately, black and brown young people tend to attend schools with peers who live in low-income communities. And we have a lot of educators who enter these schools but have experiences that are so drastically different from the experiences of the young people that they serve. And they care, and we all want to make a difference. But as an educator who has a completely different experience and background, I need to be equipped with the knowledge, with the skills, to begin to change my mindset and my beliefs about the work that I do and the young people that I serve. So that's just what I wanted to add there.
Yes, I couldn't agree more with what you shared in terms of healthcare as well. Too often, providers look at the patient or the client as the one that's different from us. I'm normal. The patient's the one that's different from me. That patient's the elderly person, or the patient's the Latino participant, or whatever it may be, as opposed to looking at, I have my own knapsack of identity that I bring to the table, and I'm interacting with someone that has their own set of identity. And how do we facilitate that interaction in an effective way, especially with the constraints in a healthcare environment? Limited time, not having adequate interpreters, those kind of barriers. I also just want to add that I think structural competency is really important. So having the ability to understand that what we often see as symptoms, disease, those kind of negative traits are often rooted in policy-level decisions at the systemic level. So, for example, in a training once in talking about cultural competency, the issue was that a Latino parent had used her child's social security number to pay for electric bills throughout the child's life. And so when the child became 18 years old, she now was in debt at no fault of her own. And so part of understanding this was understanding Latino boundaries and how Latino families work and having a very collective nature of the Latino family. But I think the other thing that gets missed often is understanding that this family was poor and it was trying to survive. And that if the family had other resources in order to pay the electric bill to survive, they wouldn't be relying on these inappropriate, what we often would label as inappropriate boundaries. So really understanding the structural causes of what we looked at as abnormalities or dysfunction, essentially.
I guess as I'm listening and thinking about my experience, you know, cultural competence is like human competence. It's about empathy. And the more work I do understanding some of the social-emotional development of young children and even adults, I'm really starting to believe that we are so focused on academic skills and on getting kids to a certain level on a certain test versus measuring kids' social-emotional competence. And some of the great work by Phil Zelazo at University of Minnesota and then Ellen Galinsky translating this into a book called Mind in the Making is that social-emotional skills are just as teachable and executive function skills just as teachable as reading and writing and math. And the better someone's social-emotional skills are, the more empathic they are, the less defensive they are. But then you got to throw in stress. The more stressed somebody is, the less they're able to see someone else's perspective. So that's sort of what's running through my mind as I listen. And at the legislature, you know, when you do the budget, you hear from a lot of folks who feel underrepresented, aren't getting what they need. I think that it's about compassion and empathy. And how do we support our young brains developing those skills? And as an early childhood educator, and I hate to like feel like there's a gap, but I'm really concerned when preschoolers are at circle for 30 minutes learning sight words, instead of in dramatic play learning to sort out some of their disagreements. You can teach kids to read by the time they're four. We can do it. We know how to do it. But if you spend that time teaching them to read at four, it takes more work. Are we better off than if we taught them to read when they were five or six, give them the pre-literacy skills, give them those, teach those executive function skills that when they get to first grade, they're ready to read to learn like this? I know I never learned till first grade. I seem to be doing okay. But I really worry, and I'm afraid. You know, I was at a very prestigious lab school in the Midwest, and I said, you know, where kids have a lot of internal controls, and I said, now why don't you have more children from the neighborhood school here? And they say, oh, those kids, they need more structure than we provide here. And, you know, I've worked in Frog Hollow as a toddler teacher. Every kid can learn internal controls. It's a teaching. It's just like teaching to read. So I'm afraid we have to be really careful to focus on teaching emotional skills that lead to empathy to build what we want to build. And I will just say my family took in an African-American student last year who had a lot of life challenges and lived with us. It was one of my wife's students for a year. I was so culturally incompetent. You know, here I've like worked in mixed communities my whole career, and until I saw the number of microaggressions that this young woman faced every day because of poverty, because of race, you know, we all have really far to come, and I think we do need more teachers of color in the school who can help everybody build understanding and have that empathy and perspective, because we all are learning every day, and really it's about how do we build a community that's just, that is one nation, like one nation, and it doesn't feel like we're moving toward that ideal since Brown. It just hasn't been realized. So,
and we have to grow some teachers of color.
We do, absolutely.
So it starts right there at the preschool.
It really does.
It really does.
Let me jump in. some of the scholarship and work I've done is around institutional agents, right? Institutional agents or educational institutional agents are, you know, admission staff in colleges, financial aid officers. At high schools, it's principals, it's guidance counselors, it's teachers. To sort of frame a little bit about what I'm going to share with you now, they have a really powerful tool, right, that is working with students, right? They have really, really strong ability to be able to shape students' thinking, their learning, right, their decision-making in terms of thinking about college applications and so forth like that. Really strong power. So it's really important that these individuals are properly trained in competency, and I like how you sort of framed it. You said human competency, because I too look at it more broadly than just multicultural, right? Or looking at race or ethnicity, although it's very important. Race and ethnicity, I don't want to discolor that, right? It's really important that we also emphasize that, right? But we need to be thinking about competency in terms of other SES factors, right? Thinking around educational attainment of the parents, of the students themselves, their families, right? We have to also think about immigration status. Are we really being sensitive, right, to those students that are potentially undocumented in the way that we're treating them, in terms of the information that we're providing them or not providing them? How is it that you speak with students, right? And in terms of microaggressions that you brought up, you know, there's a rich, rich, rich literature, right, that looks at constant ways that youth, and even adults, right, are microaggressed because of issues of race, issues of gender, right? And I'm gonna go ahead and say it, immigration status as well with research I've done, right? We're constantly going into that, right? So we need to go get into teacher ed programs. We need to get into guidance counselor prep programs, right? And being able to equip students, right, with the information that they need, right? Because microaggressions could also be lack of giving students the information that they need in order to make proper decisions, right? These well-intentioned people, right, that are these institutional agents, they don't have the skills at times or the full set of skills that they need in order for them to be successful and properly give the information to students.
That's University of Hartford Professor Kenny Niehenhusser. You're listening to a panel presentation on Leveling the Playing Field, part of University of Hartford's Empowering Change celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. Also on this week's panel were State Senator Beth Bye, Hartford Public Schools Chief of Staff Ghislaine Ngunu, Marie Spivey, Vice President for Health Equity at the Connecticut Hospital Association, and University of Hartford Professors Karen D'Angelo, Health Sciences, John Tapper, Elementary Education. I'm Diane Orson. This is Where We Live. More from the panel after our break. This is Where We Live. I'm Diane Orson. Earlier this week, I moderated a panel at the University of Hartford called Leveling the Playing Field, Access to Quality Education and Healthcare. It was part of the school's Empowering Change celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. The panelists were State Senator Beth Bye, Hartford Public Schools Chief of Staff Ghislaine Ngunu, Marie Spivey, Vice President for Health Equity at the Connecticut Hospital Association, and University of Hartford Professors Karen D'Angelo, Health Sciences, John Tapper, Elementary Education, and Kenny Niehenhusser, Educational Leadership. I asked the panel about policy and legislative mandates that are in place to address the issues. Here's Beth Bye.
As a policymaker here, I will tell you that I'm really concerned that policymakers have in some ways gotten too involved. We all have ideas. We all think this is important, that is important. And there are many important policies that have changed the world. In fact, it seems like every 20-year-old I meet in college is an education policy major. And one year a legislator may have this idea about cultural competence. Another year, this is an idea about reading. Another year, and all these laws pass. And I think about some of the challenges Southern has faced with their education program being on probation. But when you look at all the number of classes we require, how's the college supposed to decide, here's what we believe we need to teach our teachers about instruction, And here's what it takes to get there when they have to meet these 19 disparate regulations. I think as a state, Connecticut could lead the way by backing up and saying, could we take an audit of every law we've passed about what teacher education programs have to do, what schools have to do, what,
Amen.
You know, and say, what matters? What are the 10 things that matter? And get behind a universal policy about excellence in our schools. To me, that starts with excellent in communities that are supporting families as a primary unit, helping them get housing and food. And then how do we help move those families through the education process from birth on? So that would be my not a usual policymaker statement.
Anyone else?
I will agree that we do need the support and the partnership of our legislators in doing this work, because no one entity can do it alone. Just thinking about the Elementary and Secondary Act, otherwise known as the No Child Left Behind Act, I know I personally tend to discredit it, but we have to recognize that it did some good, right? It exposed a lot of inequities within schools, across schools, and throughout our nation. But it's not enough. It's not enough. I think an area in which we are lacking, and which is very timely now, is looking at the over-criminalization of young people at younger and younger age in our school systems, in our communities, and the criminalization of men and women of color. And I think our policies have to move towards looking at intervention measures, looking at preventive measures, so that we can move away from having all these disciplinary practices that are inflicted on our people and our children in our schools. We don't have enough policies that do address that tough reality. I think one hope that we have, and in Hartford, we are thinking about how to actually make this a reality. There's a new dual capacity framework that was just created at a federal level to help to build the capacity of school systems, but also to build the capacity of communities in becoming effective partners in the educational process of children in communities. It's very new. It's only a few months old, but it's an area where I see space for creating a collective conversation so that we can align agendas, we can align efforts, and we can create systemic coherence in the work that we do. So,
I'm going to stop here so that we have a few minutes for questions. This gentleman here.
Thank you very much. I'm President and CEO of St. Francis Care here in Hartford. My question is really focused on how can we really move the needle in a much faster and grander way. And I'd love the panel to comment on making the business case for all this, because as everyone knows, the color of America is changing dramatically. And next two decades, you know, the Caucasians are the minority. The world's changing. If we continue at this level in having this type of disparity, both on the economic, education, and healthcare level, our country is going to come to a crashing halt. I mean, if you do the math and understand really the economic gap between the haves and have-nots and so forth, and we're not investing in the future, and the future is the investment in that aspect of our community that we're talking about today. So I just want to see if you can comment on the business case and how can we get that message across to the leaders of across the country in that. Secondly, it's about how can we move the needle better in convincing our leadership that they have to take action. You know, for example, on the hospital level, you know, we are really trying to get boards of hospitals to be reflective of the community more and more, because they really need to understand who they serve and how they do that. So the diversity of leadership and the commitment of those leaders to make change, because unless the boards of hospitals and leaders in our organizations commit themselves to dramatic change, it's not going to happen. So, you know, two things. One, business case, and second, helping drive the leadership.
So I'll just say a couple of words about that. In terms of the business case, across the country right now, there are regional health equity councils.
And within those councils, there are discussions around the class standards, around how business leaders are coming together with healthcare leaders, or what we call here at the University of Hartford, inter-organizational collaborative coalitions. And these groups that are coming together are talking more about how we can look at the money that is being spent on healthcare, particularly in the United States, and how it's continuing to go up. I think there was one of the stats that I saw was we here in the United States spend $2 trillion plus dollars a year to patch up our bodies, and more than twice the average of what other industrialized nations spend, and our healthcare system is strained to the breaking point. So this is the kind of information that has to get to business leaders and ensure that we're talking to each other rather than just talking within our own groups. That's just one piece of it. With the hospitals, we're trying here to improve the diversity in the governance boards of each of the hospitals. They are very cognizant of the fact that they have to report to the Connecticut Hospital Association on what their boards look like. Are they reflecting the community? Are they reflecting the community? And if not, and what kinds of strategies are in place to improve that? Increasing diversity of the C-suites, of the senior management and managers throughout the hospitals, again, to reflect the communities that are being served. The cultural competence, education, and training goes throughout, and not just for 45 minutes once a year, but throughout the year, and opportunities and strategies to improve the cultural integration within each of the hospitals. We're also looking at a bit of the business piece, is to look at the suppliers, the vendors that are in our communities, and many are vendors of color and women that have wonderful products that the hospitals haven't realized are out there. I had a call the other day from a woman who, I hadn't even thought of it, who is servicing the waterfalls or water boards in the hospitals and the aquariums in the hospitals. It just never occurred to me that this was a product that one woman, one person of color, thought of and began this business and is now gaining momentum throughout our hospitals. So there's encouragement that needs to come from the communities and our better interaction with them.
Good morning. I'm Denise Best. I started out my career as an elementary school teacher. I retired from Trinity after 21 years as a senior administrator, so I've kind of gone the gamut in terms of education. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking behind you at the Civil Rights Act 50th anniversary, and I'm thinking, 50 years, and really, where have we gone? I remember when multiculturalism and cultural competency and diversity training and all of that became all of the buzzwords a good 15 or so years ago. And where's that gotten us when we're sitting here now still talking about the same things? And as you were talking, this esteemed panel up here, I thought of two incidents in my own personal life. One, my daughter was well-educated, as is my son-in-law. 11 years ago, my grandson was born with a heart defect, and they were spending some time in the NICU of a hospital, not St. Francis. And my daughter was saying the nurse there was treating her with such disdain until she actually overheard her having a conversation with the doctor. She said she could see the nurse look at her and say to herself, oh, my God, she's intelligent. She's not some baby mama, you know, with several dads. And so she changed her whole attitude toward my daughter after that. So where does the training begin so that we can actually deal with some of these issues that, as you said, Mr. Tapper, goes directly to what we're teaching our teachers about how, first of all, how to teach, mm-hmm. how to deal with diversity in the classroom, how to be more sensitive to cultural differences and take those things as part of the learning at a university such as this. When you're going through your coursework, these are the things that we need to be addressing if we're ever going to affect change in the next 50 years. I mean, where do we go from here? What are the next steps, I guess, is my question.
What are the next steps? Good question.
I would just say really quickly, I do think those are two really good examples in terms of teaching, since you asked that last. Like, we need to be more rigorous with our higher ed programs and teaching. I mean, I've taught in higher ed institutions in the area, and there's a lot of pressure to give good grades. Or I know someone who was supervising a student teacher was going to give her a B-minus, and the college said, you can't give her a B-minus. She won't get a job, and her parents paid a lot of money for her to come to college here. Like, we would never say that about a doctor. And when the things you're talking about are complicated and complex, and we need people that think really complexly who are our teachers and push their way through. So I really think we need to attract our best people to teaching, take some of the money from the testing companies, put it into teacher salaries, move forward. But I think sometimes we underestimate the complexity of the task. I have a wife with a PhD from Brown, and she comes home humbled every day as a high school teacher. It is so complicated, and gets ready to go back the next day, but it's so hard and so complicated. That's who we need teaching. It can't just be, oh, well, you know, I don't really know what I want to do, but I've always been in school, so I want to be a teacher, and I'll make my way through. So I think that is part of the solution.
And I think in addition to looking at how we train teachers prior to them entering the classroom, we also have to be so intentional in how we continue to grow and develop them when they are in the work. I think our universities and colleges can't do it all. They can't do it by themselves. And once we have them in school systems, we have to figure out what the needs are. And we have to make sure that professional learning and professional development is relevant. And as a school system, we can't do it alone either. So in figuring out what our partnerships ought to be and who does what best and bringing those players to the table, we have to develop a continuous and relentless sense of urgency about what the work is. And we have to help our partners understand the value of investing in doing this work, but we also have to help them understand the cost of not doing so. A conversation I was having a couple of days ago with one of our community partners was just talking about the cost of maintaining prisons, you know, and making them aware that prisons spend, you know, three times as much money on prison inmates than we actually do on public school education students. So where do we want to place our bets and where do we want to place our hopes? So we have to have these honest, courageous, and difficult conversations and be deliberate about our partnerships and strategies.
I want to take that sort of conversation a level higher and talk a little bit about policies that we've been talking about today. And I'm very purposeful in differentiating public policies and sort of what I call sort of lowercase policies, right? Sort of system level policies that are done systems as well as organizations. And a lot of those policies are entrenched in decision making that is not favoring oftentimes populations of color. Here in Hartford, you know, we have educational tracking that is taking place by having two very different types of educational schools that we have, neighborhood schools versus our abandoned schools, right? What is that doing, right? In many ways, it's privileging, right? Those people that have the information in order to be able to send schools to their children to their schools that are higher performing, right? It's not that the schools, the neighboring schools, aren't getting bright kids. They're getting bright kids, right? But they're not getting equipped with the information and the tools that they need in order for those kids to be successful, right? So that's systems level sort of policies, right? Or system level decision making around principals, right? When they have the decision to be able to make their budget, right? So you think that's a great thing, right? But then that principal needs to make that decision of, do I hire a behavioral specialist? Or do I hire that guidance counselor? I need to go ahead and maintain the climate in my school, right? So I'm going to hire that behavior specialist instead of having that guidance counselor there to be able to properly support students, right, in their social emotional development, right, as well as thinking around, again, high school to college transition, what that college application will look like when they don't have that information at home, right, that college knowledge and information that they need in order to be supported there. Thinking about public policies, or the absence of public policies, right? Decision making that is occurring in terms of eliminating, for example, developmental education that we've eliminated here in Connecticut. What ramifications may that have for populations of color that are disproportionately the ones that are taking developmental education at public institutions? What is that going to look like? What potentially could that have for populations of color? And also public policies, right, federal as well as the state, right, that discriminates against certain populations. And here I'm thinking about the undocumented student population. They're not eligible for federal financial aid. They don't get Pell. Guess what? Here in Connecticut, they don't get state financial aid either. So what are we doing in terms of creating tracks or barriers for populations, right, in order for them to be able to be successful?
Okay, we have just a few moments left. I have maybe time for one more quick question.
It actually wasn't a
question.
Please
identify yourself.
Donna Shadipo with Connecticut Public Broadcasting. It was just a comment, and looking at the sign behind our speakers, the Civil Rights Act, and then what all went into to making it happen, the sacrifice, studying it in college, not here, sir, but at Central Connecticut, under Dr. Bess, and studying African-American history. It just strikes me of the poise, the dignity, the control that those leaders and citizens had to model every day, and how we can hide behind just nastiness and our ways, and it's just kind of dismissed as that's corporate America or that's what we need to do to get business done. And I always try to pride myself to be really built on those foundations with my family. And people often say, where are you from? And I say, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And they go, no, where are you from? And I said, Bridgeport, Connecticut, Bridgeport Hospital. Do you want to know the time? And they go, well, there's something about you. And it's those Southern principles that was instilled, you know, in myself, my family members. But all it really is just respect and dignity for one another and treating individuals as human beings. And whether they are an educated person or 10 baby mamas or baby daddies, they should still get the same respect in that hospital from that nurse, from that teacher. And then we should figure out a way to educate and to bring up and to elevate. I just feel like we have to just get back to, it's not kumbaya. It's just really just respect for one another and humans.
State Senator Beth Bye, Hartford Public Schools Chief of Staff Ghislaine Ngunu, Marie Spivey, Vice President for Health Equity at the Connecticut Hospital Association, and University of Hartford Professors Karen D'Angelo, Health Sciences, John Tapper, Elementary Education, and Kenny Niehnhusser, Educational Leadership. This panel discussion was held earlier this week at the University of Hartford, part of a week-long series of events and programs marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Today's program was produced by executive producer Katie Tolarski. I'm Diane Orson. This is Where We Live.